At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to JS on Politics. Joined in studio today by Mary Spacuzza and Dan Bice in Milwaukee, by Craig Gilbert in Washington, and Patrick Marley in Madison. Let's look at the headlines. The state Supreme Court in breaking news this morning struck down residency requirements in Milwaukee. We'll talk about that. The Never Trump movement has life. We'll talk about that as well. More fallout from Lincoln Hills. Local politics heats up, winners and losers, and your questions. But first, Mary, let's go to you first about the residency requirement decision that the state Supreme Court brought down today. What exactly did they say? What was the ruling?
They said that the city of Milwaukee can no longer require its employees, especially police and firefighters who had brought the lawsuit, to live in the city of Milwaukee. It struck down a basically 75-year-old ordinance that they were required to live in the city, and Mayor Barrett is obviously not happy about that decision. He accused the Supreme Court of attacking local control. He said it was the result of one-party rule at the state capitol. It's obviously controlled by Republicans. He's a Democrat. But obviously unions are celebrating the decision, saying it's about freedom and rights.
And it didn't start with the Supreme Court. It was the legislature that first overruled the residency requirement, which, as some people point out, is an interesting issue since the Republican Party is largely the party of local control, and they're the ones who said that the residency requirement should be removed, and this Supreme Court decision upheld that law, saying that it trumped the ordinance.
And that was from 2013, so it was. It's basically been in the courts pretty much since then, so this ended that.
What did the city argue? They argued that the local control...
They argued essentially home rule, which is the state government cannot trump local control, that this is a local issue, and that local governments have the power to determine things that affect their city directly. But the argument from the unions was that this is not just a Milwaukee issue, this is a statewide issue, and that it is appropriate for the state legislature to decide issues of statewide importance.
So 5-2 decision, it was an ideological breakdown, as they often are, the big decisions, at least at the state Supreme Court. What did the two dissenters say?
They said that the city of Milwaukee should be able to make its own decisions, that this is that local governments do have power, and that this home rule amendment should be, that Milwaukee should be left alone, essentially.
It's an amendment in the Constitution that, as she said, says that it's called the home rule amendment, and the legislature can only overrule those in a couple of situations, and the debate is this residency requirement a local issue or a statewide issue? And the unions were saying that the legislature's in charge of the welfare of municipal employees, so this is a statewide issue.
Mayor Barrett, of course, said this was a political power play, that this was about one-party rule in Madison, and that Republicans were only paying lip service to local control, but really just wanted to strip it away.
It's an interesting thing because you have the unions at the center of this. The police and firefighters unions have been fighting this forever, and they finally, with the Republicans in control, and it's odd for this Republican legislature, which has been so aggressive in attacking the public employee unions, that they actually did what the fire police unions wanted to have done.
The fire police backed Walker, though, right?
The Milwaukee ones did, not
the not the other
not
ones.
Statewide.
Yeah.
Right.
And they backed Justice Rebecca Bradley. They've backed quite a few conservative candidates over the years, the Milwaukee contingent, not the statewide.
Yeah, that's the exception.
So what's happened since the city has stopped enforcing residency? Do we have any sense of what the impact has been so far?
They did not have statistics today about how many officers and firefighters and other employees they project will move out of the city, but they stopped enforcing it during this court battle. Mm-hmm. So as a result, there are already police officers, firefighters, other employees living outside the city. The city had said that if they won, they would go back to enforcing it. So I haven't seen statistics of what the numbers might be, you know, and I don't think they'll necessarily be a mass exodus all at once. But, you know, Mayor Barrett said, I want police officers, I want firefighters in the community. And he pointed to some recent examples of off-duty police officers who have thwarted armed robberies or other crimes, and says, these are the people I want living in town and want coaching and, you know, being part of the community.
I don't think anyone's going to deny that it changes fundamentally some things about Milwaukee, not just that the police officers are going to live here, but there are neighborhoods that are known as police and firefighter neighborhoods where a lot of the right. people are there, and all of us know that. So, I mean, it's going to over time change those neighborhoods.
So is this over now? Is there any chance for appeal?
When we asked the mayor about that, he seemed to say, like, this fight is done, and seemed pretty resolved that unless there was a different makeup of the legislature, that this wouldn't continue. I guess somebody could conceivably appeal, but it did not sound like that was in the works.
Okay. So let's move now to a tape segment with Craig Gilbert. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert of the Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau. And Craig, Donald Trump may have had a better day yesterday in terms of attacking Hillary Clinton, which is what Republicans would like him to do, but there's still some dissension. You're hearing that there might still be delegates who would like to oust Trump.
Yeah, well, the Never Trump movement never dies. There are delegates and people on the outside that are still hoping to find a way to deny Donald Trump the nomination. A lot of people in the party are skeptical that they actually have a path to doing that. I've been talking to Wisconsin's Republican convention delegates this week, and most of them haven't heard from any organized Stop Trump movement. Many of them are skeptical that it's viable. But what's more interesting is that for many of them, they just haven't closed the door in their minds on the possibility that Trump might not be the nominee. In other words, it's just remarkable to me that at this late date, there are people that are still kind of watching and waiting to see how this unfolds, that either aren't entirely reconciled to a Trump nomination or still wondering whether there could be some scenario where the party turns to somebody else.
Yeah, well, so I saw a poll yesterday that showed that there is still a number of Republicans who want somebody else, but who might that somebody else be?
Well, that's the problem for the Stop Trump movement, is there is no candidate, there's not a lot of leadership. That's why even some Republicans who are sort of sympathetic to the cause and who are clearly uncomfortable with Trump at the top of the ticket are skeptical that there's a way to get there because of the lack of leadership, because of the lack of an obvious alternative candidate. And, you know, there are also some Republicans. I talked to Tommy Thompson yesterday who think that a full-blown effort to deny Trump the nomination would be even more damaging to the party than a Trump nomination would be. I mean, that's a debate that has Republicans within the party coming down on both sides.
Is there any way to gauge how widespread among the delegates the Stop Trump movement actually is?
Yeah, I think it is limited in terms of active participation. The larger group of people are those, you know, who could be persuaded under the right circumstances, but are skeptical that it's going to happen and don't quite see how you get from point A to point B. They're sort of watching and waiting, and for some of them, you know, it doesn't feel quite right, the idea of, as someone put it to me, changing the rules after the fact and denying someone the nomination who's got the delegates to win the nomination. So it's really, what you find when you start talking to convention delegates is that they're sort of all over the map on Donald Trump, and they're all over the map on where this convention is heading. A lot of them just don't know what to expect. They just know that it's not going to be like any other convention they've attended. Yeah.
So I saw Marco Rubio interviewed yesterday. Of course, he's now running again for Senate. And when asked if he would campaign for Trump, he essentially said no. What do you make of that?
Well, again, there are we've seen every gradation, every possible nuance of a position that people, Republicans, can take on Donald Trump has been taken by elected Republican officials. I mean, just look at Wisconsin, where Reince Priebus, chairman of the RNC, is all in for Donald Trump. And then you've got Paul Ryan, who's endorsed Donald Trump but doesn't really defend him. In fact, he's frequently a critic. You've got Scott Walker, who's sort of made kind of intimations about whether it's still possible to stop Trump. You've got Pete Ribble, a Republican congressman who's an outright never Trumper. So there is nothing resembling a consensus in the party on any of this.
Well, Craig, thanks so much for your time today.
Great to be with you.
And now let's go to Patrick Marley in Madison. We're going to go now to Patrick Marley of our Madison Bureau. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks, Dave.
You bet. There's more news out of the troubled Lincoln School, Lincoln Hill School for Boys this week. Bring us up to date.
Well, the latest thing we reported on was about a case that happened in the fall. We just got records on it recently about a woman in October was working at Lincoln Hills, and an inmate brushed against her breasts and then a few hours later brushed against her groin. She reported this. She went back to her living unit where the other inmates taunted her, and she was very upset about this. She told her supervisors. They reported it to Madison. They told her they would let the police know about it. But she waited more than 2 months before she heard from anybody, or about 2 months before she heard from anybody. And when she did, they were internal investigators, and they were asking her if she had invited this touching. And they sent her spent 7 weeks on an investigation of her and what had happened to her, as if she were the perpetrator of this crime,
rather than the victim.
Right. And only in the midst of this did she learn that law enforcement really hadn't done anything on this, and then she reported the crime on her own, and at that point in December, it was investigated as a crime. Ultimately, she was exonerated, in part because she produced evidence that an inmate had told another staffer that he was going to make up charges about her to try to get a different staffer fired, and ultimately, this 17-year-old was charged with fourth-degree sexual assault.
And now there's a charge. I want to go back to a story earlier this week, though, that talked about the difficulties that journalists have had in getting records regarding Lincoln Hills. Talk about that and what's been happening.
Sure. Well, this case is a good example of that. I first heard claims about this botched investigation or the victim becoming the sort of the subject of an investigation in December when this thing was happening. And I put in a records request at the time. First, they denied it because the investigation hadn't been concluded. And then we waited months and months. I made a subsequent request with the name of the employee in it, and they denied that, citing a provision of the state constitution that protects victims' rights. Eventually, we had our lawyers involved, and they reversed course on our original request, and 6 months later, we got this. But that's just one example of the many delays that we've faced in trying to get records about Lincoln Hills, and there are many other requests that we've had that have been denied outright. We've had to involve our lawyers. It's been a lot of work on our part to get records that do belong to the public.
And what kind of explanations have you been given, other than the ones you've already noted, about why you couldn't get the records or they would be slow in coming?
Right. They vary a lot, but, part of the reason is because there are ongoing investigations on a number of fronts. You know, it's important to remember that Lincoln Hills is under an 18-month long criminal investigation. There have been many internal investigations of employees. While they're pending, they won't let you have material. Information about juveniles is generally protected, so they have to black out the names of juveniles. They have to black out information about health matters, so anything to do with a suicide they won't tell you about. Any video they won't give you, and so they've got a lot of, we made a lot of requests. They've got a lot of laws that they need to look through for confidentiality, but it can take an exceedingly long time to get records from them.
I wonder what the political fallout has been so far from the revelations about Lincoln Hills and what else might be coming politically.
You know, I'd say there hasn't been a lot of political fallout from this at this point. We've known about this investigation for about 6 months. Republicans control the legislature. Democrats have been calling for legislative hearings on this. Republicans have rebuffed that, saying they want the criminal probe to sort of see its course and then review whether there are any changes that are needed. We're pretty far away from a governor's election. So this has not really been, some Democrats have tried to make it more of a political issue, raising it in Joint Finance Committee meetings, but it has not seemed so far to gain a lot of traction.
And one final question on the story about the woman who was sexually assaulted, allegedly. There's some indication in your article that this might be ripe for a lawsuit. Is there any sign of that yet?
There's no sign of a lawsuit at this time, but I talked to an attorney who's the head of the Wisconsin Employment Law Association, and I spelled out everything that had happened here, as we reported in today's paper. And he called it a ripe candidate for a lawsuit. He said that it's the kind of circumstances that, if proved in court, could very well anger a jury, and in those situations they give large awards. People can recover pain and suffering coverage. They can recover their attorney's fees. So there's a big risk to the state if this is if a lawsuit were to be brought and if it were successful in court. The other thing that the state would have to be very concerned about if litigation is brought is that if there were an attempt to make it sort of a pattern, if they tried to prove a pattern, if other women came forward, if there were other complaints of this nature, then other examples of the state not following up properly on sexual harassment, the state could find itself in serious legal trouble.
All right. Well, Patrick Marley, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
I'm back in studio with Mary Spicuzza and Dan Bias. And Dan, there are a number of local elections that we need to start paying some attention to.
Well, June, July, August usually is a slow period for
voter rooms, right?
Everybody. But yeah. Actually, there are a lot of races going on and a lot of competitive races. So actually, we're going to all have to put our vacations off a little bit. We have two Senate races that are very good. Lena Taylor running against Mandela Barnes. Lena's the incumbent. Mandela has a lot of support from other people, including Senator Chris Larson. So that's going to be highly competitive. Lena's working very hard on this. Mandela's out there doing the same thing. And then there's another Senate race. Senator Nikia Harris-Todd is not running again. Do you remember who all is running for that?
Yes, there are three. So this is the primaries, obviously.
Right.
So there are three Dems running for the seat, probably because Republican.
And these are all Milwaukee area races. So who wins the primary wins the race.
So there's a state rep, LaTanya Johnson, and then Michael Bonds, our school board president.
Who
and then
really wants another job, apparently.
Yes, because he also had run for city.
He's
ran for common council back not that long ago in April. And then there's also Thomas Harris, who used to be a legislative aide.
And then you have the race for Mandela Barnes' seat. Former state rep Jason Fields is running for that position against a Democratic Party activist named Daryl Gibson. So you have these three races, and usually the turnout's not very good for races like that. But then you have a big county race, too, and that's for the district attorney's office, which we've talked about before, and that's John Chisholm against Verona Swanigan. So four highly contested races going on right here, but there are also some out-state races. You're involved covering one of the races.
So obviously Speaker Paul Ryan is facing a challenge from the right. Paul Nyland, who is kind of taking the Trump train, he's accusing Speaker Ryan of being a sellout. He says that he's been terrible on trade. He's a businessman who says he's created jobs and knows the district better. He's kind of accusing Speaker Ryan of forgetting about Wisconsin and just focusing on his own political ambitions.
And that's the reverse of the city races. Whoever wins that primary is likely to win the race there. And then you have another race for Reed Ribble's seat. Reed Ribble's not running again and for Congress. And so you have three people running, the two front runners on the Republican side, Senator Frank Lissay, whom we've talked about. Where exactly does he live? Is he in the district, out of the district, or where is he in today. And Mike Gallagher, who also people have been raising residency questions about, how long has he lived there? And has he lived there as long as he says he had? And Gallagher worked for a while for Governor Walker's presidential campaign. So, and Frank Lissay has been in the legislature forever, was in the assembly and then to the Senate. And a number of senators are holding a fundraiser soon for Frank Lissay. So again, a very highly competitive race. And but in that case, it's very different. There is a very strong Democratic candidate, and so it's not sure who's going to win, as opposed to those five other races.
Mm-hmm. And this is all happening because we have a primary coming up in August.
Well, we changed it from it used to be in September, and now it's to August. So things used to slow down during this time, but now the races are going to be won and lost between now and, you know, over the next 2 months.
So, as usual, expect to see candidates in your 4th of July parade. but let's talk about the Lena Taylor, Mandela, Barnes race for a minute. It's sort of unusual to have a sitting senator, a powerful senator, get a challenge as strong as Mandela Barnes. What's going on there, and how are Democrats lining up?
Well, Lena has alienated a number of people, but at the same time, what's going on that's a larger issue is Congresswoman Gwen Moore is, you know, she's been there for a long time and is expected to retire in the next couple cycles, and this is basically a runoff to see who would be the front runner to replace her. That's the larger context of what's going on. And it would be hard to argue that that the winner won't be at the front for that position. And I don't believe Congresswoman Moore has gotten involved in this race. She did get involved in the
county execs
race. Mm-hmm. But she hasn't in this race so far.
And Senator Taylor is obviously very outspoken. She's clashed with Republicans, but she's also clashed with Democrats, and even Democrats that she agrees with politically. It's just been, you hear rumors.
Well, there's old Chris Larson.
Yeah, and actually right, he said that during that debate with Mike Gushee, when he said, why did he take her off of Joint Finance Committee? And he said, because I don't like her. So it wasn't like some ideological thing. It was just, it's Lena. Why wouldn't you take her off? That was his perspective.
Okay, well, why don't we move to our winners and losers? And Dan, let me start with you.
Oh.
Your winner.
It's easy. LeBron and the city of Cleveland. This is a big week for them. And, it's now, how long has it been since Milwaukee has had a championship now? It's like 40 some years. So we moved sort of to
thanks
the front.
Thanks for bringing that up.
to the front of the pack now that Cleveland has been moved up. I think Buffalo still is the longest without a winner, and maybe San Diego's never had a championship team. But you know, it's a big thing to come back from 3-1 and to.
I guess we can't count the Packers. We have to stick with Milwaukee teams.
You could, but
probably not. Okay, Mary, your winner.
My winner would be obviously from today's ruling. The local police and fire unions are probably celebrating at their union halls or possibly in the streets about this ruling. This has been a long fight, and they've been pretty outspoken about what they want.
And your loser?
I would have to say Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is not exactly the winner of this court battle. He had been arguing that this was really important for the city to have people part of the community, and that is not going to happen. So I think him and the city of Milwaukee, who are probably going to see a number of police and firefighters heading out of town.
Not that it wasn't a surprise that the Supreme Court came out this way.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sort of expected.
It would have been a huge shock if they didn't, basically.
And it would have been a huge shock if it weren't 5-2.
Our story would have said, like, in a stunning turn of events, something like that.
No stunning turn of events.
No stunning turn of events today.
Dan?
My loser is talk radio host Jay Weber. I posted a story today on his remarks on Senator Baldwin saying that she failed to act in the Toma VA scandal. She would have acted if some of the dead vets had been gay or lesbian, but they weren't, so she didn't. Talk radio guys frequently say things that are intended to be provocative, but this seemed a little more crass than usual. He initially said, maybe I crossed the line, but then came back around and defended what
basically
he said.
Basically doubled down. All right. Which the talk radio folks sometimes do as well. So let's go to some questions from our viewers. Here's one that might need a little context, but does the Democratic Party chair, Martha Laning, really not know who John Lewis is?
Bill in Beloit says that's embarrassing for Wisconsin Democrats.
The context is that there's a Twitter kerfluffle going on right now. Martha Lanning, the head of the Democratic Party, made a mistake and meant she was discussing John Lewis, the longtime congressman and civil rights leader, and she referred to him as Joe Lewis. So the former spokesman for the Democratic Party, Graham Zielinski, comes out and attacks her, calls her an embarrassment, and says he can't believe that she doesn't know the difference between John Lewis and Joe Lewis.
And John Lewis was leading the sit-in in Congress over the failure to take up the gun legislation yesterday. So the answer
to the question, I have no idea if she doesn't know the difference between Joe Lewis and John Lewis. So Joe, was the boxer.
So related to that, the next question comes from Paul, and I don't think this is Paul Ryan, although it's about Paul Ryan.
So this one's yours.
Okay. So Speaker Paul Ryan said in his press conference this morning that Democrats are pulling a stunt and politicizing a tragedy so they can fundraise. Didn't Mark Pocan learn anything from the Wisconsin recalls?
Let's see. Are they saying they're going to try to recall Mark Pocan? Because that might be a tough fight to win in his district. But, I think Speaker Ryan was saying it was a publicity stunt. I think another conservative accused them of resorting to, tired 1960s tactics. But, they're trying to draw attention to the issue. There was this high-profile shooting in Orlando. They basically... see that nothing's probably going to be done, and they're trying to draw attention to it.
Well, and in the House as opposed to the Senate, the rules are such that when you're in a minority, you're basically in the minority, and there's not much you can do.
Right. And I would say, too, that I think there was a liberal operative who pointed to all of the times that Republicans have voted to repeal Obamacare, saying, is that a publicity stunt, or do you really think Obama's going to go along with that? So I guess neither side is exactly.
But Republicans
has never done
are in
a
control,
publicity stunt.
And they're not going to do anything on guns. So to be able to point at somebody else and say this is a publicity stunt is to change the conversation.
Okay, well, I have to leave it there. Thanks so much to Dan Bice, Mary Spacuzza in Milwaukee, and Craig Gilbert in Washington, D.C., and Patrick Marley in Madison. That's it for JS on Politics for this week. Thanks for watching.